who've been regular members coming to Posse Rounds realize that we're trying to be cross-cutting and pick topics of general interest to all 27 institutes and centers. And I'm really excited today to explore the field of pharmacogenomics with you. It was very easy to make a decision about who should come talk to us about this. Dr. Dan Roden from Vanderbilt University has really been a leader in this area from the very beginning, who's already done a lot of very high-impact research. If you look at Dan's career, there's some interesting themes. And the one theme is he was sort of built for pharmacogenomics. He started out as a clinical pharmacologist in the field of cardiology. And as the field of pharmacogenomics developed, at each level in his career, his title sort of changed to evolve with it. He is the director of an institute of clinical therapeutics called the Oates Institute at Vanderbilt. But most recently, and I should congratulate you, he's been named, I won't get it exactly right, but the assistant vice chancellor for personalized medicine. He may be the first vice chancellor for personalized medicine in the country. I thought Dr. Zerhouni would be interested in that title. So I'm thrilled to have Dan here today and Dr. Roden.
Well, Alan, first, thank you very much for the opportunity to come talk. I'll correct one thing that you said. You said I started out as a clinical pharmacologist. I still consider myself a clinical pharmacologist in many circles. And these are the titles you did, in fact, get most of them right. It's traditional to end with this slide, but I think I should start with this slide. And that's the a lot of what I say, and actually the opportunity to think obsessively about pharmacogenetics has been provided by our participation in the Pharmacogenetics Research Network. These are the nodes of the network, and it's fair to say that in its first incarnation, I think the network spent a lot of time focusing on individual science, and we've spent a lot of time in the last cycle trying to be more general and think about how to move the whole field forward. What do we think? So this is I originally outlined this slide, called this slide the roadmap, but I think that it, for this audience, that's probably not the right word to use. So this is the outline of what I want to say. I understand that I'm supposed to talk for 25 to 35 minutes, something like that, and it'll be like that. So a little bit of history, a little bit of sort of where we are and why people are interested in this. Two quick cases, one of which comes from my own personal obsession with the drug-induced arrhythmia field, and then a little bit more about how the field is moving, and then I can't resist the opportunity with this audience to sort of blue sky a little bit about what kinds of things we will need to move the field forward in an incremental fashion. And I understand that my job is to provoke discussion after this, and so I'm not going to talk for an hour or anything like this. I will say that most of the examples I'll give relate to my fascination or obsession with arrhythmias, but I want you to take those examples as examples of how one can take a problem and move it forward using the kinds of tools that that we've developed in the Pharmacogenetics Research Network. So it's not meant to be entirely self-serving. The idea that we vary according to our genetic constitution is a pretty old one, in fact. Garrod, who's famous for coining the term inborn errors of metabolism, commented on this over a century ago, and for those of you who think that I collect old books, this is directly from the World Wide Web. And this is a quote, and I think this is right from the introduction. The idiosyncrasies with regard to drugs presumably have a chemical basis. So the notion that we biotransform drugs, just like we biotransform endogenous substrates to cause diseases like alkaptonuria, the idea that we would biotransform drugs to cause variable effects was proposed as long ago as this. So one of my favorite quotes is from I'll tell you who quoted it first, but I'll just read it to you. What's good for one of you will kill the person next to you. Every one of you has a health that is unique and totally different from everyone else because we are all like snowflakes. And that is actually from Lewis Black. Lewis Black, for those of you who don't know, is one of the sort of more profane comedians on the current scene. Very funny guy, and I was really struck when he said this because it sounded like he was being serious for about 1 second, and then he goes on to be less serious. This is a slide that I think I may have gotten from my mother. And this is like 5 or 6 years old, and it was a big joke in the New Yorker, ha, ha, ha. And, of course, now here we are with people actually doing this. There's a commentary in this week's New England Journal from Jeff Drazen on what to do when your patient comes to you with his 500,000 SNPs, which his children bought for him as a Christmas present, and how you can interpret that information. So 23andMe and Decode and other companies are getting into this in a pretty big way. I think this is interesting. It says down here, recruit a friend and get a $50 refund on your genetic scan. I think that says something about the field. So a little bit of definition. People use these terms sort of interchangeably, but I think that there are differences. One is this is the snappy definition, that pharmacogenomics is just pharmacogenetics with two SNPs, from Urs Meyer, who's a distinguished pharmacogeneticist and genomicist. I think this is a more reasonable view, that pharmacogenetics, at least the way I think about it, is the idea that single genetic variants cause large phenotypic effects. And that's been around since the days of Garrod, and there's a huge field built around that. We're moving towards a genomic world, everybody in this room understands that, where the idea is to ask the question whether there are differences between individuals across their genomes, across populations, across genomes, and within individuals that make them more or less susceptible to unusual drug effects or to disease susceptibilities. Those are two sides of a similar, not identical, coin. So one difference, though, is that this can be done in small populations. And in fact, pharmacogenetics usually starts with the observation of some aberrant drug effect in a single individual. I'll give you two examples of that. Population genomics, on the other hand, requires large populations. And this is one area where larger is better. And I'll come back to that toward the end of the talk. So I don't want anybody to get too carried away with the little details here, but this is a man who I took care of for a long, long time, had terrible heart disease, and he got an antiarrhythmic drug whose name is dofetilide, and it is a potent, high-specific blocker of one particular potassium current, and only one. So it's a nanomolar potency blocker of this particular current, and 2 days later, he gets this arrhythmia, and this is a drug-induced polymorphic ventricular tachycardia, the so-called torsade de pointe syndrome. So let me just tell you a little bit about what happened to him. First of all, about up to 5% of people who get this drug will have this adverse effect. It's also a problem with so-called non-cardiovascular drugs, antipsychotics, antidepressants, antibiotics, antihistamines, urological drugs. You name it, the FDA gets interested in it. So it's a huge issue in drug development, although the incidence is much, 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 much lower than this. All drugs that cause this response block this particular potassium current, IKR. In this particular individual, and I can spend an hour on him, and I don't want to, he has actually a mutation, not in the genes that encode this particular potassium channel, but in the genes that encode another cardiac potassium channel. And the notion is that, in fact, he has a subclinical form of a congenital disease called the congenital long QT syndrome that occasionally causes that same arrhythmia, but in up to 50% of people is asymptomatic through life until they're challenged. And this man was challenged by having heart disease and by receiving this drug that blocks this other potassium current. So you have to start to think about this not as a single current problem, but a problem of multiple currents, each one of which contributes to maintaining normal physiology. Losing one of them is not a big deal. Losing two of them through drugs or mutations starts to reveal a phenotype that you don't want to see. At a more general level, one of the things that people think about when they think about pharmacogenetics is this idea of rare adverse drug effects. Drug-induced long QT syndrome, drug-induced liver disease, drug-induced rhabdomyolysis during therapy with the statins are the sort of high-profile examples, Stevens-Johnson syndrome, and they all get a lot of press, and this is one of them. I like this one because we can identify cases and we can identify controls. Finding the patients and making sure the case is a case and the control is a control requires somebody like me, who looks at each one of those electrocardiograms. So it does, the phenotyping is a problem, and the phenotyping is a problem across pharmacogenomics, I think. We can identify a series of candidate genes and pathways. I'll come back to that toward the end of the talk. One of the problems is that large numbers of patients, mercifully, are not affected. So it's very difficult to come up with 10,000 people in a replicate sample set. It's just not going to happen for any of these rare adverse drug effects. So that's a generic issue which we're trying to cope with in some way. So let me tell you about a second case, which is, again, centers around a patient. 34-year-old woman goes to the dentist and every time and gets codeine. And every time she takes codeine, she gets nauseated and euphoric. Now, codeine, it turns out, is not a drug. It's a prodrug. And it's biotransformed by this enzyme, CYP2D6, to morphine, which is the active metabolite. 7% of this room are poor metabolizers. I'll tell you the mechanism in a second. And in poor metabolizers who receive codeine, they don't generate morphine, and they have reduced analgesia. The patient I just told you doesn't certainly generates it, not only generates it, but seems to generate a lot of it. And I'll come back to the mechanism like right now. So if you look at large numbers of patients and ask the question, what is the distribution of CYP2D6 activity, how this assay is done is not terribly relevant, but you can see that the population divides into two groups, a group of people who don't metabolize or who have very little enzymatic activity, and then another group of people who have a lot of enzymatic activity with a big distribution. And it turns out that this woman is at this end, and most of the people who are at this end of the distribution are actually so-called ultra-rapid metabolizers. And the reason they're ultra-rapid metabolizers is that they have gene duplications. The record is 13. This woman is unusual because she's Caucasian. In certain parts of the world, in Northeast Africa and Saudi Arabia, this is pretty common. 10 to 20% of the population are ultra-rapid metabolizers. So poor metabolizers are homozygous for loss-of-function alleles. So the little black means that that's a loss-of-function allele. And this group here, this big group in the middle, are people who have one or two wild-type alleles. Presumably the one is down here and the two is down here, but they don't separate very well. And again, these ultra-rapid metabolizers, many loss-of-function alleles have been described. Many reduction-of-function alleles have been described. And one of the themes that recurs over and over again in genomics and pharmacogenomics is the distribution of those alleles varies strikingly by ethnicity. And that story generalizes. So the one that I've been talking about is this one here. And you could tell the story again for any one of these enzymes. These two happen to be areas that people in the Pharmacogenetics Research Network are obsessed by. Also this one, also this one. This is a cancer one. This is a common for proton pump inhibitors. This is a big one, but it doesn't have a little green box around it, so you say, well, it's probably not important from a pharmacogenetic point of view. In fact, this is the most important drug metabolizing enzyme in the liver, and it's strikingly variable in its distribution of activities. And the thought is that there are no coding region variants that are important in this, but there are certainly regulatory region variants. So I think that every single one of these drug metabolizing pathways, regardless of whether they have a little green box around them or not, is going to turn out to be important or is turning out to be important for variable drug effects. So if you want to think about mechanisms underlying variability in drug response, there's variability in drug disposition, so metabolism, conjugation, variability in the drug targets. So thinking about my potassium channels, variability in the way those potassium channels respond to drug exposures, or variability in what I call the milieu in which the drug-target interaction occurs. So that means that, you know, a lower serum potassium makes drug binding to some of my channels more effective. So anything that controls serum potassium turns out to be a candidate gene for this kind of mechanism. And that's just a simple example of the milieu kind of problem. And then I think a big problem is variability in the disease mechanisms or the adaptive responses to disease. So I thought I would digress for one second and just say this. You can read the philosophical note. But the notion is that when I go to my clinic, I see people with atrial fibrillation, common arrhythmia, and everybody treats them the same way. But in fact, that's probably 10 or 50 different diseases. I was having a discussion with our director of our diabetes center. We were talking about how to distinguish between type 1 and type 2 diabetes. And he said, well, what about type 50 diabetes? And he thinks that there's that many categories of diabetes. And similarly, treating depression or schizophrenia, I don't know why I have two neuroscience examples on here. I don't want to pick on anybody. But I think it's the same regardless. So one source of variability in response to therapies for common diseases is variability in disease mechanisms. I don't think that's the only source, though. And I think it's very important to say that some of the variability is attributable to disease genomics. But there are other factors, and we're developing a body of evidence that says that response to drugs is modulated by a different series of genes, including the genes that control drug metabolism, but not just those. So this is the easy example. And everything I've said really is sort of just introduction, because this is what really happens when you expose patients to drugs. And this is sort of the nasty hidden secret of contemporary pharmacology, that if you these are four different examples from four different centers in the Pharmacogenetics Research Network. They happen to be cardiovascular examples, but that doesn't matter. They can be cancer examples as well or anything else. So if you expose patients to a statin drug, very, very, very widely used drugs, and if you expose large populations, you reduce cardiovascular mortalities. There are some patients who derive a great benefit, and there are some patients who derive very little benefit. So what you will hear is that this drug at this dose lowers LDL cholesterol by 41%. Sounds great. And if you happen to be in here or here, that is great. But if you're here, taking the statin all your life may not do very much. We just don't know. It's very clear from very large trials, and guidelines say that everybody should be on a statin if they have heart disease. But it's clear that some patients benefit a lot and some patients don't. These are studies that we did and a group of normal volunteers challenged with a QT prolonging drug. And you can see, again, some patients develop a big pharmacologic effect. Some patients develop less pharmacologic effect. And if you look at the average, yeah, that's a big change in the QT interval. But again, it doesn't transmit the idea that there's tremendous variability. Blood pressure lowering, change in FEV1 in asthmatics, these are the three colors of three different trials. And that story repeats itself. So when you see efficacy of drug response, you're always exposed to this number here or this number here, but not to this number or this number. And I think that's a very, very important part of what we do. I like to say that the most common adverse drug effect that people ever encounter is failure of drug efficacy. And if we could solve that, we'd be a long way forward in terms of applying genomics to the bedside. The other point I guess I should make with this is that in every study, there seems to be a small population of people who respond the wrong way. Now, whether that's just biological chatter or whether that's real biology is a very interesting question. But in every one of these studies, there's a little group of people, sometimes not so little, who develop the wrong response. And yet we tell people they have to take these drugs based on populations. So faced with a distribution like this, what's a guy like me supposed to do to try to figure out what the difference is between this tail and this tail? And I put up here, my QT interval, but you could just erase this and erase this and erase this and think of any drug response you want. So one thing, without worrying about the genetics, is, is this African Americans and this is white people? Is this women? Is this men? Is this old people? Is this young people? They're clinical discriminators. What is it that makes some people end up in one group versus another? Some of those are genetic, of course, but you don't need genetics to do some of that. And then a common approach is to ask the question, what about those genes that encode IKS or all those potassium currents that this guy seems to be obsessed by? Maybe there are different variants in this group versus this group. And you can genotype all the patients for common variants. You can resequence some of the patients, like these ones here and these ones here, to identify rarer variants. And people are doing both of those kinds of experiments. Both of them have their advantages and disadvantages. This one here sounds terrific, and I think this is where we're going to go. But what you end up with is a huge collection of rare variants, and you don't know which one is real or not. What you end up here is with a set of data that needs replication, and that's a problem as well. I can't give this talk without saying something about whole genome association, but the problem is that you have to have large numbers of patients with well-phenotyped drug responses. And it's hard enough to accumulate large numbers of patients with diabetes or large numbers of patients with premature coronary disease or depression or whatever your phenotype is, let alone patients who have been exposed to a drug in a uniform, systematic way and their drug response phenotype collected. So I think there are groups within the Pharmacogenetics Research Network and outside who are using this approach. We're thinking about it for some of our QT stuff. There are problems with replication sets. There are problems with numbers. And there are ways around that in the sense that you can look for simple phenotypes, you can start to do these studies in model systems, those kinds of approaches. And then, so because of these difficulties, what people are focusing on right now is thinking about a pathway approach. So let me just tell you about a pathway approach, and because Rochelle Long, who runs the Pharmacogenetics Research Network, is here, I'll give her a little snippet of data that she hasn't seen before. So this is the arrhythmia antiarrhythmic drug pathway. This is a generic cardiac myocyte with lots of inward currents and lots of outward currents and calcium handling mechanism. And I'm not going to bore you with the details of how myocytes work. These kinds of pathways are posted on the PharmGKB website. And each one of these functional elements can be associated with expression of a set of a gene or of a set of genes. And this alphabet soup is the alphabet soup that we're obsessed by, but every other pathway has its own alphabet soup that they're obsessed by. And if all genes that control, if all genes are the genome, then all genes that control rhythm are what we call the rhythmogenome. And I like that word. And you can, you know, the one that I like the best is all genes that control blood clotting is the thrombone. So what can you do with that kind of pathway? Well, one possibility is that common variants within this set of genes modulate risk. So you can identify the variants and then genotype patients and controls. And you can do that at a single genotype, at a single candidate, at dozens of candidates, or large numbers. And this number is the number of SNPs that will fit on a single Golden Gate assay. And that's I'll show you one little set of data from that. Risk might be conferred by many private variants, so we need technology for cheap resequencing and information management. I'll come back to that, but that's an area that is moving very, very, very quickly, as you all know. It's possible that the rhythmogenome doesn't include what we're looking for. There are genes, but we just haven't been able to find them. So genome-wide is the approach there, or model organisms. And we've been tinkering with zebrafish and are getting somewhere. I don't have time to say much more about that, but it does reflect the idea that pharmacogenomics embraces many, many disciplines and many, many approaches. And then the final hypothesis, which I'm unwilling to accept right now, is that genetics is all irrelevant to this, and there are other factors that are driving variability in responses. So what we've done is a candidate approach. I can't resist showing this because it's never been shown in public before. We've accumulated, along with people who are as obsessed with the QT interval as I am, the largest by far collection of these things in the world. So 329 cases takes more than a decade of work by lots and lots of sort of obsessed investigators. We have a set of drug-exposed controls without drug-induced long QT syndrome. That was collected at our center through the Pharmacogenetics Research Network. And then some population controls, including a German, central German population called CORA, which is the central German equivalent of Framingham, if you will. And for our assay, we didn't take the whole rhythmogenome, just the ones that are in red, and anyone who wants to know why we chose those, I'll be happy to talk about that later. I'll just point to you that this is the target for the drugs that cause this funny effect, and this is the gene complex in which we found that mutation in that one individual. And what's interesting, and this is the way the data are displayed, I have to show that because it took a long time to generate this picture. And what we have is we have 1,530 SNPs, 1,500 plus SNPs, but only five lit up when we did the analysis the way we did the analysis. And four of them are actually in that complex that controls that other potassium channel. So I think it's pointing us to some new biology. The question is, what do those SNPs actually do, and how do they operate, and is this replicatable? And those are all questions that we're grappling with right now. So where is the field going? I think the first thing to say is that exploring the idea that genes determine variability in response to drugs carries with it discovery of new mechanisms. And we've done our share of that. And again, I'm not going to say anything more about that except to say that every time you discover a SNP that's associated with a variable phenotype, whether it's a drug response phenotype or not, whether it's a coding SNP or not, the next question, it seems to me, is why? And the why question then leads to new science and new therapies, perhaps. So pharmacogenetics, people ask when it's going to have an impact on healthcare. It's having an impact already. Drug companies are very, very reluctant to develop drugs that are metabolized exclusively by CYP2D6. Anyone who's been exposed to the drug industry knows that, and that comes out of this kind of work. Drug companies are very, very reluctant, and the FDA is equally reluctant to approve drugs that markedly prolong the QT interval. What markedly means is a long, tedious debate, and how much QT interval prolongation one can tolerate is an interesting question. If we had better ways of predicting patients at risk, that might help. And then the idea of selecting patient subsets for drug trials is we're not there yet. There are a couple of examples of that, but by and large, that really hasn't moved yet. But it's an obvious way of enriching the responses and getting rid of people who are at high risk for abnormal responses. And then the big challenge is delivering this whole business to the bedside. So As Alan said in the introduction, I've sort of spent my time taking care of patients and trying to figure out how to do that better. And I think that this kind of information is poised to do that. And how to do it is a huge, huge challenge. So let me give you a little thought. This is the electronic medical record from the patient who I presented to you first. And you can see that he has pretty extensive heart disease. He has all these things here. He has lots and lots of different medications. He has lots of significant procedures. And my thought around the turn of the century was that eventually we'd get to the point where when I call up his record, this is actually the first sheet that I see, it would not only have this, but it would have something like this, a list of interesting genes. And everyone is in blue because the doctor will then click on the blue link and find out all they need to know about the variant. And maybe the ones that are really important would be in red. And I've come to the conclusion that this is a pretty naive way of approaching this because, you know, this man has hundreds of thousands of variants, as do we all, and it's not going to be delivered in this way. I think it'll take information technology to sort of say when you're prescribing a drug for this patient, there'll be an interface that says, wait a second, this patient has this set of variants and you shouldn't do that or you should change the dose or whatever. And physicians don't have time to click on links when they're busy seeing patients in clinic anyway. So the barriers to implementation at the bedside are considerable. And I've listed them here. I was told Alan at dinner last night that the first part of solving a problem is to list it, is to just write it down to sort of say what the problems are. So when is a validated association good enough to enter clinical practice? This, you know, people have done surveys of pharmacogenetic research, and that part of it that's translational tends to be the early part of translation, not the how good is the test and how does it affect outcomes. I wouldn't argue strongly that we have to have, against the idea that we have to have all that data before we implement tests, but I will tell you that when I go to clinic, I am astounded by the number of patients who have C-reactive protein measured. And that's in clinical practice, and it might even be in guidelines. And where the data are, that doing that expensive and pointless test makes a difference is beyond me. There is no question that there's very, very interesting biology behind that. But so I'm not saying that because those guys get a free ride, the genetics guys need to get a free ride. But there is this sense that if you demand large clinical trials that demonstrate efficacy in large numbers of patients, that really is counter to the notion of individualized medicine. But how to generate the statistical and outcome evidence that says when a test is good enough to enter clinical practice is something I think people are still struggling with. And again, I write it down because I think it's not a simple question. There are interesting ethical questions. I don't put that up just to sort of dismiss it. And as I get more and more involved in genetics and pharmacogenetics and thinking about when to tell people they have an abnormality, or maybe you should always tell people they have an abnormality, but if you don't know what to tell them about the implications, what to tell them about the therapies, then there are some interesting ethical issues. There's computational issues around, you know, what's real and what's not. Technological, I write down there, but boy, there are lots of companies that are developing really, really interesting technologies to get us to the point where point-of-care genetic testing for a single variant or a couple of variants is pretty easy. It's expensive and cumbersome to deploy, but I think that that's going to be a midterm solution to the idea of getting everybody's genome or everybody's variants into their record. And then there's all these economic issues, including some very interesting questions around who is going to pay for this, because if you have a – just come back to the genetic problem for a second. If you have a patient who has a genetic disease, an important question is who in the family is affected. The payer will not pay for genetic testing in the proband because, and if I were a payer, I'd say, why should I pay for that? Because you are already treating that patient for that disease. You already know this patient has hypertrophic cardiomyopathy or congenital long QT syndrome or cystic fibrosis or whatever. Why should I pay for that test? Because the real beneficiary is somebody else who I don't even insure. So it comes back to this perverseness of individualized medicine confers an interesting set of thought problems for the payers, for the people who organize healthcare systems, as well as for physicians. I can't resist the idea of preaching to this audience about what it is we need. But before I sort of come up with my little shopping list, I'll just tell you that if you haven't got the message already, that pharmacogenetics is really, really interdisciplinary. It's not interdisciplinary in that, you know, there's no geology for entomologists. There certainly is biology for mathematicians. And interestingly, whenever I showed this slide, I said that's the only one. But in fact, I think this is a huge issue in pharmacogenetics as well. There's a big anthropological facet to all this. So. These are my thoughts, and as I thought about what it'd say, there's not anything that people in this room haven't thought about and aren't investing in. There's not some gaping hole that needs to be filled, and of course, you know, everybody wants more resources. I don't know how to allocate them. That's the thing that you struggle with every day. But I will say that. One of the things that we come up, one of the barriers we come up against increasingly is because we're getting better and better at sequencing and resequencing is we find stuff. And every time you find stuff, you have to ask yourself, does that mean anything? And so there's a big, I think there's a big scientific underpinning to finding some of the variants because if the large numbers of variants mean nothing, some variants mean a lot. And there needs to be ways of marrying that and figuring out which ones to act upon, whether that's functional, whether that'll require modeling. You know, the ultimate vision for a person like me is somebody comes up with a new non-synonymous SNP in a channel, and you just plug that into your favorite structural biology model and come up with a clear sense of whether that's functional or not. This will affect new drug development as well. So as we discover new biology, we discover new targets. There's huge informatics needs, which you are aware of, but they get bigger and bigger as we try to bring things to the bedside. And statistics, these are obviously related to each other, but how good is the data and how to deliver it is interesting. And then I put this as a final point, but it's really not a final point. You can't get anywhere unless you define the phenotypes. And I don't think there are many people who can define the drug response phenotypes except well-educated investigators. Well-trained investigators, and that justifies a lot of the investment in training. But how to get there is an important and interesting question. And then there's another set of needs related to the populations, the payers, and education. And again, education in this sense doesn't mean educating the phenotypers; it means educating the physicians who actually use this information right now and who really have. Alan was telling me yesterday that if you go to medical grand rounds at many places and ask people what a SNP is, you might actually be surprised that people don't know. I hope that's not the case at our place, but I've never taken the survey. So no therapy is uniformly effective. And given that, and given the kinds of investment that drug companies and people in this room make in assessing new therapies, is it, I'll turn the ethical question on its head and ask, is it ethical to do large trials without recognizing that responses will be variable and that there will be questions at the end of the day about whether there are genetic predictors of that variability in response? And so is it ethical to do the studies without collecting all the information that you might need? And that includes genetic information. And then how to understand the added value of pharmacogenetic or genetic testing in general, from developing tests to figuring out whether they work or not, figuring out what their predictive value is, and then their clinical value, requires very, very large data sets. The role of payers, I've alluded to that as well, and I know this isn't, I know lobbying isn't the right thing, this isn't the right place to lobby, but we do need the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act increasingly, and education I've said something about. I'll close by being amazingly self-serving for 1 second and just tell you about an idea that we have in terms of approaching this, and that's the generation of a large DNA data bank, and I wish there were more people around who are investing in this kind of thing. We are, and a number of other places are as well. So the notion is that if the state of the science is sort of here, we're just discovering stuff, and we want to move it to the bedside, how do you do that? You have to have a test bed in which the informatics tools will be developed, in which the information, in which the statistical tools will be developed, in which we figure out how to apply new sequencing and other kinds of genotyping technologies. And so the idea is that we have an intermediate test bed, a routine patient visit, get a DNA sample, and hold on to it. Or genotype a large number of people at a large number of sites so people can start to figure out how to go from here to here. And I'll close with this picture, which is that was the idea in 2004. 3 years of work finally led to implementation of our plan. And this is the sea of samples that we accumulated on day one. And so I'll close by showing you this sort of generic sea of samples and ask you if you can figure out who has the snowflake that's perfect and who has the snowflake that's not quite perfect. So thank you for your attention. I'd be delighted to participate in the discussion.
Well, thank you, Dan. That was great. So as we all know, APASI is about discussion. So we'd love to hear people's ideas, questions, comments about the field. And maybe while everyone's looking or thinking, let me just ask one to get started, which is talking about the snowflake, talking about your linear pattern. Behind all this was systems biology kinds of things. I don't think you mentioned the word once.
Okay.
And is there, does that technology exist? Does the need here of understanding how we're a snowflake and how do we get there and things
so,
like that?
So I'm sorry for not mentioning the term. I think I told you last night that when my son was looking for a career after he'd graduated from Carnegie Mellon with a degree in taking apart computers, because they all do that at Carnegie Mellon, I said, like the graduate, you know, I said, I have only one word to say to you, and that's systems biology. So I'm a big believer in that, and I think that the idea of looking at a myocyte and saying, well, it's not one potassium current, it's all this stuff put together that generates a normal or an abnormal phenotype, and where the choke points are in that sort of so-called signaling system or that complex biology is a key crucial need, and I apologize for leaving it out, but I think it's very, very, very important. It's part of the computational needs that we have. I mean, as we discover SNPs, you sort of say, well, you know, which one is important? Or is one SNP important? Or is it a collection of SNPs? And how do you get at that? Those are systems biology questions that I think need answering.
And are we close to it?
I don't think so. In modeling the cardiac myocyte is a tractable problem. I like to tell my neuroscience friends that modeling thinking, maybe I just don't think broadly. I think that's a very, very difficult problem. I can tell you that modeling the behavior of something as simple or as seemingly simple as the heart is really, really an interesting, difficult problem, but I think it's tractable. People are getting there in terms of modeling a single myocyte and modeling how myocytes talk to each other.
And people are working on those kinds of problems in every other discipline, in cancer biology, in neuroscience, in other areas.
Interacting in multiple ways. But within that line of thinking, to what extent does, for example, when we're designing a clinical trial, and you say that our pharmaceutical industry is very interested, can we start to use these as parameters to try to get more homogeneous samples such that we are more effective in determining whether, in fact, there is an effect or not? And to what extent should we be guiding by one's need, which evidently in my brain may be too simplistic, as opposed to having concepts that are ready to blend within this network that buffer one another when there's an abnormality or anything for the other?
That's a great question. I don't think we're at the position of answering that yet. So let me just say something about this idea of subsetting patients. We subset patients all the time. So we'll do a trial of a drug in women. We'll do a trial of a drug in African-American populations. That's been done. Now, it's very controversial whether that was a reasonable thing to do or not. But so we subset people by characteristics that are, arguably or not so arguably genetically defined. Anyway, there's one example from the DECODE effort of a SNP or of a variant that was discovered in the 5-lipoxygenase accessory protein as a risk factor for myocardial infarction. And what they did was they went after that as a drug target and then conducted a clinical trial, small clinical trial, only in patients who had the variant SNP that appeared to place them at risk. So the notion is you develop that's a sort of one step towards individualizing medicine. The cancer guys do this better than anybody else. And part of the reason they do it better than anybody else is that they have two genomes that they're working with. One is ours and one is the tumor genome or the tumor genomes. And I'm fond of saying that if you're a cancer investigator and go and approach your patient and say, can I have a little snippet of your tumor? The response is, yeah, please take it all. But I've never had anybody say that when I come to them and say, can I have a snippet of your heart or of your brain? So there is a fundamental problem, but I'm digressing. But I think you're absolutely right that we're just at the point now where we're being able to define how this might work. I don't think it's going to be single SNP based. I think that we've sort of moved beyond that. But as you move towards more and more complexity, you have to have a way of reducing that complexity because we're not going to be able to manage 500,000 SNPs and figure out which combinations are important in every patient that we see. There's not enough people on the face of the earth to power any kind of reasonable study. So you end up with this idea that there's a demand for outcomes in a setting where it's just not possible to do it in the traditional way. So that's not an answer, but there it is. It's a problem.
Question, if I may, related to one of the major points I think you made in terms of translating this field into practice, the warfarin story and the CYP2, C9 polymorphism. The FDA has made a big push in terms of changing the drug label for Coumadin. The test has been approved. But as you mentioned, many people are still demanding large controlled clinical trials to see if that really changes the way we deal with dosing of Coumadin. So, and, of course, the main issue is to try to prevent bleeding in people that are not able to metabolize the drug properly. So what is your view of that?
I'm delighted that you asked, because I wanted to put something in about warfarin, because it's everybody's favorite question, but I decided in the interest of time not to. So here's the warfarin story from the way I approach it. If you had asked a clinical pharmacologist 3 years ago, what is the source of variability in response to warfarin? The answer would have been, oh, everybody knows it's variable drug metabolism and this thing called CYP2C9, one of the ones that had a little green box around it in that slide I showed. And there are a couple of variants that are pretty common, and if you have two variants, then you're really at high risk for excess drug effect unless the dosage is reduced. And then along comes, identification of a new player in warfarin response, and that came from studies of two patients who had the syndrome of warfarin resistance. No matter how much warfarin you give them, they had absolutely no response. They turned out to have non-synonymous coding region SNPs in a gene called VCORC1, which is the part of the vitamin K receptor complex. It turns out that those are very, very rare patients, but there are common variants in the promoter of that gene that determine mRNA expression within the liver of humans. And so people have looked very quickly at CYP2C9 and VCORC1 as a, which one plays a role. And the first group was a group at the University of Washington. They looked at a group of patients who are on stable doses of warfarin. I don't think that's the right approach. I think you ought to take people who start, because once they're on stable doses, you sort of know you've gotten rid of all the funny responders. We have a study that's now accepted for publication at that journal in Boston. It took forever to get that. So you'll see it in the next couple of weeks, we hope. And the notion is that CYP2C9 plays not much of a role at all in the first couple of weeks. It's just VCORC1. But the outstanding questions are there other genes? And does any of this make a difference? You talk to your medical ICU guys, and they sort of roll their eyes at the idea that we're going to do genetic testing for warfarin, because they say, well, we get it right all the time. Well, in fact, they don't get it right all the time, because the idea of sort of sticking everybody on a single dose and then measuring the INR 3 days later and hoping that they don't overshoot. What that happens usually is they undershoot, and then they increase the dose, and then they have a patient who's bleeding. So I think that there's some added value, but that's a personal opinion. So the FDA did something interesting, and I don't know what possessed them to do that, but they changed the label. And so I was at a meeting of the Personalized Medicine Coalition, something that I sort of participate in occasionally, and I was on a panel and with a guy who runs United or Cigna or one of those large companies, and the question was, how do you evaluate new genetic information? How do you decide whether you're going to pay for it or not? And they went through this long song and dance about, you know, the way they have technology assessment, and we think about it, and outcomes, and what have you. And then somebody from the audience said, well, what about Coumadin? And he said, well, Coumadin is easy. It's in the label. We have to cover it. End of discussion. So rather like 23andMe or Decode, who have just, you know, moved that tool out to the public and let's see what happens. I think the FDA has done the same thing. They sort of said, well, you know, the evidence be damned. Let's just go ahead and put it in the label. Now, I think that there are rare patients, uncommon patients, who will have dramatic responses to warfarin, and that can be avoided by knowing their genotypes. Whether it is useful to roll out to large communities is still unknown, and NHLBI is planning to do a big trial. And the real question when you do a big trial is, should you do it with just those two genes, or should you wait until we make sure that there's not another big player? Because you don't want to be halfway through a trial and say, oh, look, the algorithm we're using is wrong, or something like that. So those are the kinds of questions, and people are working on that. And one way in which the field has been moved forward is we have a big collection of patients with warfarin outcomes and genotypes, and there are other groups around the world. So we've aggregated those under the pharmacogenetics research, under the PharmGKB, the knowledge base at Stanford, into something called the International Warfarin Pharmacogenetics Consortium, which has almost 6,000 patients with warfarin outcomes across ethnicities with genotypes. And that'll be the platform that we'll use to figure out whether there are other genes that we need to look at and what the dosing algorithms might look like for the big trial that NHLBI is going to do. So it's sort of like, you know, here's the problem, and there are solutions to that. And I think but the question is, if you do a trial, how do you resolve the tension between a benefit in one or two patients versus a failure to demonstrate benefit in a large, large population? And I think that that's the sort of fundamental difficulty, or the fundamental tension that you have to struggle with in this idea of individualized or personalized medicine. Across populations, it may not be possible to show a benefit, but within individuals, it's hard to argue that you haven't. But how do you get the statistics to prove that? I don't know. But that's the warfarin story. Thank you for asking.
I'd just like to segue into the question I wanted to ask you. And that is that when you look at large populations, you have obviously heterogeneity. And you said that about diabetes being maybe 50 diseases, and schizophrenia may not be one disease, and depression may not be one disease. So it's clear that as we go forward, there will be a need for a reclassification of disease stages, types, and so on some basis. And people are hoping that maybe genotyping will be that basis, and that will lead to a molecular reclassification of disease. Well, if that happens, then you understand the change in the strategy of trials, that you won't have a one-size-fits-all trial. You'll have a very specific molecular classification slash match to the drug you're trying. Tell me more about what would lead us to that.
Yeah, before I answer the question, and if I don't, remind me to answer the question. It's possible that the subsetting will occur at a phenotypic level rather than at a genotypic level. People in hypertension are very interested in the idea of, low renin and high renin, and that's an old idea, but that presumably reflects different mechanisms as well. So I think that we will. So if you'd asked me 2 years ago, I would have said, I just don't know how to get at that. That's just because I've been taught that diabetes is a multifactorial disease or coronary disease is a multifactorial disease. There's just no way to get at that. But I think with the results from the genome-wide associations that we're seeing that are really in large, large numbers of patients replicating loci, that it's entirely possible that we'll end up with reclassifying coronary disease as, chromosome 9 locus plus chromosome 9 locus minus. A huge question is what that chromosome 9 locus is. For those of you who don't know, there's now data, certainly over 40,000 patients, that identifies repeatedly a locus on chromosome 9 in genome wasteland, of course. So it's not a SNP in a gene that everybody understands, but that it's very compelling that it's there. So I think that if you'd asked me 2 years ago, I would have said, I have no idea how to do that because there's 20 different genes or 50 different genes. But it's possible that as we use that kind of information and information that comes out of other ways of looking at disease in a sort of unbiased, if you will, fashion, that will come up with new markers that are small in number and that actually inform biology. But so I think the jury's not out yet. Type 2 diabetes looks like there's a handful of markers that really do together predict risk. So I'd have some optimism that that's going to be conceivable, and it won't take 10,000 SNPs. Because it can't take 10,000 SNPs. I think you can identify a dozen or half a dozen. That would be a big step. But it's just inconceivable to me that we'll have a collection of SNPs. Now, it's possible that out of the systems biology efforts will come some kind of collection of variants that together make a pathway not perform the way it should or not. I think that's a little bit further in the future. But I'd be pretty optimistic for some of the very common diseases that the genome-wide association, which my genetic friends tell me that's all going to go away in the next 2 years because it's all going to be done. I'm not sure that's true, but I'm not sure it'll all be replicated. But I think that there's cause for some optimism because the results are really pretty amazing. It happens. And I think the same way you sort of have to have some skepticism about, genome-wide or pathway associations in arrhythmias or in asthma, but it looks like there are the biology may actually be tractable. We don't know yet, though.
If I can follow up, if you don't mind. So let's assume you're right. Let's assume we find these, qualitative markers and combination thereof, and you find 10, 15, whatever. Mm-hmm. Obviously, those are qualitative indicators of an underlying reality, biology, hopefully, that is relevant. But qualitative markers, no matter how long you can observe them and study them, will never, in my view, be able to tell you quantitatively how these pathways and the components of the pathways interact. So at some point, you have to move from the qualitative to the quantitative, which is a little bit what you imply when you say we need better models, better population, better science, interdisciplinary sciences, and so on. Well, how do you see that ongoing? In other words, there is a connection, really, between genomics and in the other omics.
Oh, yeah. Well,
on a quantitative basis, right?
No, so just following the chromosome 9 story for a second, I think there seems little doubt that there's a marker that confers increased risk for coronary disease. No one has any idea how that works. It doesn't look like it's related to anything that we know anything about. And it would be really lovely to figure that out, figure out the biology, because then proper tests might follow, better drugs might follow. But I think, so that's why I think that, that genomics in isolation, it's like arguing with the informatics guys who have no conception of what a hospital bed looks like. I mean, I work with them constantly, and it's have I just insulted somebody? Probably, but I think it is interdisciplinary, and you do have to use the information and not as an endpoint. So that's my objection to 23andMe, for example. I mean, it's out there. Most of it is unvalidated. Most of it is probably wrong. And yet it's sort of being consumed by the consuming public. So I think what our job as a science community should be is to find it and then figure out what it means to advance the field in that way. Now, and it's possible that we'll end up with a new signaling pathway in coronary disease or in asthma or in schizophrenia that through this new biology that will actually inform new drugs or inform new pathway analysis. I don't know how to do the pathway analysis, except to say that in my field, there's some hope that it's doable. But it's the cynics say, you know, give me five exponentials, I can describe an elephant. Give me a sixth, I can bring him to water and make him drink. That's just a way of saying these problems are really, really, really underdetermined, and there's probably no way around that problem.
Just to follow up on that a little bit, what if it's more, I mean, I hate to say this, but what if it's more complicated than that? What if it's epigenomics, and what if the causes of what you're seeing now are in, let's say, early childhood exposures, in utero exposures that reset protein and gene expressions, and that leads to these what we might call intermediate phenotypes that you might actually be able to bring out, but not in the static way like you measure blood pressure or cholesterol, but more in a dynamic challenge way where you're looking for blood pressure variability, let's say in reaction to a standard stressor, because that may reflect, in fact, that ongoing trajectory of subtypes that leads to these vulnerabilities. So I'm just wondering how you put that all into this equation. And it brings in, obviously, environment, brain, stress, cortisol, and neuroendocrine cascades from brain to organ systems, but also things like diet.
Right.
Because what about the vitamin K, Coumadin, diet variability story, and where does that fit into this picture? And if you're not controlling for that exposure, you've got big problems with measuring the other gene interaction.
No, a huge problem. So let me take one step back or 10 steps back and say that in the interest of full disclosure, I don't think genetics is the only variable that affects human physiology. Okay. I think it's one. It's an important one. In some settings, it's probably more important than others. I think there's a need for understanding how the, you know, one thought is that the, you know, the so-called genome, you know, sets, what is it? Genome loads the gun, environment pulls the trigger. And I think that's a facetious way. And if anybody here knows who actually said that first, I'd love to know, because there's millions of people who have said it, but I'm not sure who said it first. But I think it's a very nice way of saying that there are huge influences starting from early childhood and including everything that we do to patients. And so there are people who clearly have bleeding episodes from Coumadin on a stable dose because they ate too much spinach. There's more to life than the genome. But on the other hand, to make it tractable and to move understanding individual variability forward, this is one way of doing it, with bearing that in mind. And so I think that if everything is a gene by environment interaction, I mean, the things that I study are environmental influences. They're drugs, but in one sense, pharmacogenetics is just another model of environmental influences on a static genome, and I take your point that the genome is obviously not as static as we might have thought.
Just to follow up a little bit more on that, I think one of the implications of this is that I think there is a big gap in our science, and I think the area is what I would say going from systems biology to integrative systems biobehavioral environmental exposure as an interaction. And I think in a sense when we talk about genetic vulnerabilities and we focus very much on the gene variation, the weakness in that is that it's to use another proverb, it's a little bit like that Chinese proverb of it's the sound of one hand clapping. Although the human genome studies deserve lots of applause, in a sense the applause would get a lot louder if you had both hands clapping. So I think there's a huge challenge there that if we don't get better ways to measure and mark that individual level exposure to extracellular factors, whether it's in utero and early childhood or early adverse environment and stress that we now know changes the trajectory of, let's say, depression expression in young adulthood, as in CASPI studies, where you have to have an adverse environment and the short serotonin transporter gene. If you have one of those and not the other, you don't see the expression in change in vulnerability in depression in later years. So you're not going to really tease this apart unless you take much more seriously the bridging and the integration of better measures of these early exposures at the individual level, because you're looking at individual gene variation interacting with individual unique environmental exposure.
I'm tempted to ask you to repeat that question, but I won't. I think there are a myriad of examples of exactly that, and part of the problem is how to actually get at those very complicated phenotypic influences and how to characterize the phenotypes. The thing that I'm fondest of saying, just to take another example from my own world, is that I'm not sure who I should pick. I'll pick on Alan, and I'll say, you know, so Alan and I are sitting here phenotypically indistinguishable for the sake of argument, but if we both occlude our left anterior descending coronary arteries in the next 10 seconds, the odds are one of us will fibrillate and one of us won't. So one of us dies and one of us doesn't, and that, it looks like it has a genetic component, a big genetic component. So, and there is from where I sit, that's an important gene by environment interaction. You don't know about it until the environmental influence is there, and it's, you know, or he takes warfarin and I take warfarin. One of us bleeds into our head, and the other one doesn't have an embolus. So all of that is just to say that genes load the gun, environment pulls the trigger.
It's a more benign experiment.
Yeah, no. And I always say that it's him that fibrillates. Whenever I say that story, as I'm resuscitating you, I say, I wonder what your gene variant is, that because it's never me that fibrillates. I just want to say that.
Yeah, one of the areas of variability and the response to drugs really has to do with the fact that we have a melting pot of people in the United States. We've got people from all over. And one way to get around this is to go back to original sources, populations like you mentioned in Northeast Africa with the codeine exposure, or the Asians with the alcohol dehydrogenase issues, or African women with triple negative for breast cancer genes. And so my question is it useful to go back to those populations, or what do you see the value in going back to those populations to decipher some of these differences? And are there some situations where drugs that we would commonly use are terribly ineffective or are terribly toxic? And I think about, I guess, Taxol, that was where being of Asian origin helps you respond to your cancer with that drug, where a Caucasian does not have that positive risk factor.
So the answer is, I'm sure, yes. Do I have great examples of that? Not yet. But there's an emerging story, for example, with respect to tamoxifen and the role of CYP2D6 in determining tamoxifen response. It needs more work, but it really looks like poor metabolizers just don't derive benefits. So you're exposing people to a drug for no benefit if they have the wrong genotype. Now we need more data before we sort of say it's important to genotype people before they start tamoxifen. And in that regard, what the network is doing is actually aggregating tamoxifen responses the way we've aggregated Coumadin response or warfarin responses. going back and doing pharmacogenetic experiments within more homogeneous populations is a way to get at way to get rid of some of the sort of genome chatter, I think. But the extent to which the results can be then applied to other more mixed populations is a debate. So I don't think people have gone back and looked at drug responses. I'm trying to think. And Rochelle will correct me if I can. I can't think off the top of my head of people who have gone back and looked at drug response phenotypes in closed populations. Certainly, though, there's a huge interest in doing that in determining lots and lots of different physiologic and disease susceptibility genes, but it's harder to do with respect to right. Well, so there's alcohol, and then there's G6PD deficiency in African Americans as a cause of hemolytic anemia and during anti-malarial drugs. There are examples like that, but people haven't gone back and said, I am now going to look in a founder population at drug response X and see if I can tease out the sources of variability. It's an interesting idea. People do that in mice or in zebrafish, Rochelle is about to. The Amish. That's a thank you. So one of the nodes of the network is obsessed by or it is focused on the Amish population, and they have a couple of big projects. One of which is actually to look at aspirin response and clopidogrel responses within the Amish, which is a founder population in eastern Pennsylvania. That's the one they're studying. There are two Amish populations. And they're doing it. They're actually doing a prospective pharmacogenomic experiment where they're exposing a large number of people whose genealogy they understand to aspirin and to clopidogrel. They have a genome-wide association that's already been done. They're still analyzing it, as far as I know. Thank you.
In terms of new biology, one of the things that's been striking in a number of studies is synonymous or non-coding SNPs and their reality and lack of, you know, as somebody who thinks a lot about protein structure, I feel like the physicist when he heard about the neutrino who said, "Who ordered that?"
Yeah,
you know,
right. You're talking about synonymous SNPs within the coding region of or anywhere else.
So certainly synonymous SNPs within the coding region, or you know, non-coding SNPs that you would normally say that can't possibly have any effect, and then the data. I mean, I think it's pointing to new biology, and you know, again, if one of the words other than systems biology that would have been a good thing to say has been RNA few years. So.
Right. And then there was this thing in the just to deal with the RNA thing for a second. There's this set of studies in the New England Journal 2 weeks ago, using RNA interventions in muscular dystrophy. I can't remember what it was, but it was the editorial that came with it was entitled "Personalized Medicine," and it was personalized on the basis of, you know, your specific mutation is X, and therefore your specific RNA is going to be Y that we need to intervene on. The story of the synonymous SNPs, I guess the best example is still MDR1, and there's a synonymous SNP that turns up over and over again in various association studies, but you know why it should do that is the theory has always been that it's in LD with something else that regulates expression of the regulates expression level, but a series of experiments, I guess, from Mike Gottesman, showed that it makes it that you know the transcript, the RNA is generated, obviously still has the SNP in it, and the rate at which that transcript is translated is different depending on whether there's a SNP A or SNP B within the transcript. So again, I think that just points to new biology, and understanding that might be important in ways that we don't yet understand. Knowledge is good. I can't say anything more than that.
A little more short-term, sort of immediate. We've had this conversation about what would really be important to allocate resources to, you know, to help. We've had a retreat with the directors a lot about what are the implications of genome-wide association studies. And then we had this conversation about phenotyping and the phenome, and we ended up really appreciating the complexity of that, just like you described it, and decided to move away from that at this point because it's just not tractable, really.
The phenome?
Yeah, yeah. And we decided to focus on the epigenome because I think we can push the field there to really have a better understanding of those relationships. Nonetheless, I think it's important, I think, to frame the debate in the terms you did, because I think this is fantastic. This is really the way to explain the Gaussian distribution, the variation, that the phenome is not one thing. The phenome is a distribution. Would there be any merit in having a conversation about exactly doing that in terms of how we present pharmacologic results? In other words, you know, when you talk about 41% for statins, maybe we should say it's 41% plus minus 40% standard deviation, like we do for any data point.
Right.
So is there a need to educate the public in having pharmacologists and FDA and others start representing the phenome for what it is, not the phenome for what we think it is?
Well, I think that's so you point to the fundamental tension between this idea of evidence-based medicine and individualized medicine. And at some point, we'll have evidence-based individualized medicine. But until we get there, I guess my not totally facetious response is it depends a little bit on the audience. But in terms, to be scientifically fair, I think that's the way we ought to frame results in general. So you know, even the best of interventions in the fields that I know, there's no drug that eliminates sudden death. They just reduce the risk a little bit. Even the defibrillator, the sort of the thing that works the best, it's not a drug, works well for some patients, but many, many patients get them and don't need them. And that's a huge issue for us. But so I think that depending on who you're talking to, you may want to frame it differently. But I think the public needs to understand that there's no panaceas and that there is tremendous variability. And you know, there's a whole part of this that I don't think we have any control over, like the direct to consumer advertising issues and those kinds of things. But I will say that I have this notion lately that science education in this country suffers because we pay a lot of lip service to it, but we don't do a very good job. So everybody who's done grade 8 biology knows that there's cells and knows their DNA. So when they see an advertisement on at 10:30 on a Saturday night advertising something that'll change your cellular structure to make you more attractive or make you thinner, they all say, "Oh yeah, yeah, that sounds right. I learned that in biology class." What we don't teach people is how to evaluate science, how to decide whether this is good science or bad science. And so it's like a little bit of knowledge is a really bad thing here. And I think that you know where the educational mission fits in. I don't know, but I think that's part of it. And I realize I'm wandering, but I do think that the notion that drug responses are not yes or no in large populations needs more attention.
So I would assume that pharmaceutical companies, which have very successful products like the statins, would resist the notion of this distribution curve, because it would presumably remove a significant fraction of their market. If it doesn't work, people shouldn't take it. But I'm not sure that there's a direct translation of that into not prescribing it.
I think you're absolutely right. And just to be fair, that was a curve derived in a volunteer population at a single dose. And so the question is, you know, would those non-responders do better if we push the dose up? We push side effects up as well. So it's probably not the perfect way of displaying it, and there are subtleties in how you would do that. But there's, you know, if there are ways of analyzing this that are not obviously my area of expertise, but to say, well, if we treat 10,000 patients with statins, we can say, well, there's some people who are clearly going to benefit based on outcomes of clinical trials and their characteristics going in. And there are some people where the benefit is harder to demonstrate. And so in a large population, you've achieved a net benefit. And there's no question that in the year 2008, you achieve a big benefit. But the question is whether there are some people who don't need to be taking it, need to be taking something else. And we're not there yet.
So the second question is, for any NIH Institute, a very significant expense is a clinical trial, and I would certainly say for my institute, we have not yet taken into account in planning clinical trials sort of pharmacogenomics. The best we're doing is saving samples that you could then go back and do genetics on. But if we think of Parkinson's as maybe not one disease but 50 diseases, the kinds of interventions we're testing don't discriminate. And so how would you suggest you look at a cost-benefit analysis of undertaking a trial now because of pressure from investigators and patients, where if you think about it in the terms of pharmacogenomics and diversity of disease processes, we almost certainly will be unsuccessful or show only a minimum benefit?
I think you could talk yourself out of doing a lot of clinical trials, and that would be an unfortunate outcome.
Or putting the money where you think there's the likeliest benefit. We have many more opportunities to fund clinical trials, and I, at least in our institute, I don't think we've taken a rigorous look that would happen likely at the peer review or council level of, okay, this is a really good trial to do, it's well designed, there's the right, they'll be able to recruit the patients, but success and or interpretation are likely going to be influenced by factors that we don't really understand well.
So at the very least, I think the idea of sort of archiving blood so that the studies can be done is one that, you know, that if I had one thing that I would love to see this group of people do is adopt that as a standard. You know, the way it's usually done is, yeah, we'll do the investigators say, well, we'll do the trial and we'll do a genetic sub-study, and whoever wants to contribute can contribute, and it imposes all kinds of IRB extra work, and at the end of the day you'll do 5,000 patients of whom, you know, 400 will have donated DNA samples and serum samples for biomarkers that we don't yet understand or know about. And that's a resource that you don't know how it's going to work until you do it. And then we had this discussion last night about funds are not infinite, so you can't just collect them and just have them sit there. They have to be used at some point. So there should be a plan for that. But my notion would be to incorporate into the main body of trials that kind of that kind of data collection, that kind of sample collection.
I think there are other ways you could look at doing the trials, and that they would be more effectiveness trials than efficacy trials. And I think that Kaiser Permanente, for example, has begun a great big mission to collect DNA samples. I think the VA is also very much undertaking this. So if you have big pools of data, a very good informatics and phenotyping to go along with that, I think that could get us pretty far. And we're trying to get access to Medicare data, so that could really let you know what you're doing. And so there are perhaps less expensive ways and ways to really look at effectiveness.
So there's never in science there's never one way one right way and a whole bunch of wrong ways. I'll just say about the Kaiser and the VA. I mean, I know about those efforts, and I think that if the only DNA data bank in the country was at Vanderbilt, that would be pathetic. And I think that the last slide could be from the VA or could be from Kaiser. We like to think we have the biggest one in the country right now, but Kaiser is going to pass us in an instant as soon as they start to collect samples, and that's a huge resource that may help answer some of these questions. Until we do it, we don't know.
Just to add a quick comment on that, because some behavioral trials have also had to deal with these complexities in individual variability, there's been some real methodologic advances in designing what's now called adaptive clinical trials and sort of looking at continuous measures of program and process change and linking those to intermediate and final outcomes. And so picking up on what Barbara just said, the Methodology Center at Penn State, for example, has some really nice new mathematical models and tools that I think begin to capitalize on this new complexity of interactions between individual differences and group-level clustering or aggregate levels of data. And that's where I think some of this revolution really comes in, is we've got to do much more thinking about connecting individual variability that's sort of science over here and group-level variability that's more the epidemiology side of things. And if those two fields could come together and do more vertical integration of what are the mechanisms that get you from individual to cluster to macro population dynamics. The great British epidemiologist Sir Geoffrey Rose has a quote in his book from someone in 1934 who said, the distinction between health and illness is a medical artifact for which nature, if consulted, bears no confirmation. So I think that gets at this cut point versus continuum issue. But obviously in medicine, you need rules of thumbs, algorithms, and cut points to do diagnosis and treatment. But you have to recognize that under that is complexity. You know, blood pressure of 139 over 89 doesn't get treated, but 140 over 90 does.
That's pre-hypertension. That gets treated now.
Well, but in effect, that's a normal bell curve, and 70% of the population that has intermediate high blood pressure that may be very damaging for stroke and heart disease thinks they're normal.
Right.
Let me just quickly point out that in 2 months, your Posse Rounds is going to be precisely about that subject, about those clinical trials. Dr. Zahn.
You really have stimulated a lot of questions and thoughts, and that was great. If you were today to recommend a certain type of clinical trial policy, one thing that is very obvious is that we will need well-characterized populations with well-characterized related samples. And as you just said, it's hit and miss. I mean, some researchers understand that, some don't, some collect, some don't collect. There was a presentation at that retreat from a researcher, Helen Hobbs, at UT Southwestern, and the fact is her breakthrough came from the fact that there was the ARIC study in Dallas, the Dallas study, with samples. Would you be so bold as proposing maybe a prospective policy that says if you do this and you get funded for the extensive trials, that at minimum there should be to sort of see a world where there will be an interchange of database plus population plus sample databank so that you could retrospectively restudy some aspects of it? Is that something that you would see in your world?
I you said it better than I did, but I think that's what I've been saying, yes. I think that would – that. So
regardless of whether it's genetics or not.
Oh, yeah, no, sure. And serum samples and the appropriate samples for whatever the studies are. In the course of the NHLBI strategic planning meeting, I was in a room with Gene Brunwald, the father of cardiology, and he made the statement – he makes lots of statements – but he made the statement that he thought it was unethical to do a large clinical trial without collecting the genetic information that was going to be needed to interpret the trial at the end of the day. So that's the sort of the place where we are right now. And I think that people are beginning to realize that. Just as an aside, in the course of setting up our databank, we've done focus groups because that's what people do. And you ask people who walk through the door at Vanderbilt, what do you think of us creating a DNA databank? And the numbers are 85% say, yeah, that's a great idea. We think that's, and 10% say, well, I'm not sure, and 5% are livid at the idea. And we have an opt-out mechanism. I don't want to get into the details, but the numbers sort of bear that out. It's a 3-5% opt-out rate. I mean, another thing is there are very large population-based collections that many people in this room have supported, and I'm sure there will be more. And whether a genetic component needs to be added to or considered in each one as going forward is another idea. Whether there should be a U.S. biobank like there's a British biobank, that's another thought. It'll be interesting to see what that huge investment that the British are making, amounts to. But perhaps we can do it with privater biobanks, including Kaiser. But scale is going to be really important.
You'd be surprised to find out when we did the inventory that the great majority of studies that NIH funds actually do have that.
Right.
We had 119 studies. This is how we were able to do the genome-wide association study. So it seems like the trend is exactly in that direction.
I'll just say this, that there's a difference between a clinical trial where everybody's ascertained for outcome X, and they're ascertained really well, and a clinically based biobank where people are linked to their electronic medical records, and whatever happens to them happens to them. So those are two complementary but different approaches, and the Kaiser approach and the VA approach and our approach, which is, I should say, supported by NHGRI, are other ways to do that.
Well, I think we've come to the end of the 90 minutes. I want to thank our speaker, Dan, for a wonderful, wonderful talk, and all of you for a terrific discussion.
I want to thank you all. You've heard this before.
Yeah.
But it's an interesting opportunity.